When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders. It's Sean, and we are back for one of our very famous bonus episodes where we bring to you guys an interview that didn't quite fit into the main show, primarily because we had some other really cool interviews to run. This one is on behalf of Jumanji: The Next Level. Now, we already ran the interview that Kevin and I did with the director, Jake Kasdan, but while we were in Mexico participating in that press junket, we also got to sit down with the two producers of the film, Matt Tallmack and Hiram Garcia. The two of those guys are involved not just in the Jumanji franchise, but in a lot of other major properties that we know you guys are interested in. Hiram does a lot of stuff with The Rock. They're going to be working on Black Adam together. And Matt Tallmack has been the architect of a lot of the Spider-Man-related films over at Sony. He produced Venom. He's been working on Venom 2. He's doing Morbius with Jared Leto. And so we got to talk about not just the Jumanji franchise and where they want to go after the sequel, but we opened the talk up to a lot of other industry things that were really interesting to us about how 3D is used, about humor can translate on the global market and why certain jokes make it in or don't. And they were just really great to speak to because they were totally open and really liked the long form element of the podcast. So I should probably add that we do get into a few light spoilers with regards to the Jumanji: The Next Level story. Nothing major. And we tried to keep it to things that you saw in the trailers, but there were a couple of scenes that they wanted to elaborate on. So if you want to go into Jumanji completely unspoiled, maybe you want to wait a day or two to catch up with this after you've seen the movie. But without further ado, we wanted to bring you our bonus interview episode with Jumanji: The Next Level producers Matt Tallmack and Hiram Garcia.
It's been amazing. We've had the best times. I'll kick it off. Well, thank you for joining us. This is absolutely incredible.
Can I interrupt already?
Yes.
Are we rolling?
We are rolling. We are rolling.
I just want to say that people have told me I have a voice for radio.
Good.
And this is my first podcast, so I'm kind of throwing this out to the audience. You know, if anybody has a podcast idea or anything, you know, I'm available.
Sometimes they say you have a voice for radio.
A face for radio.
It's what you don't want to hear.
Yes.
You don't want to hear.
I started radio and I heard that a lot.
Yeah.
You do have a
face for radio.
You really would be great on radio.
All right.
Everyone's sleeping on Matt Tallmack for a podcast. You do have the voice.
You do have a great voice.
Guys, I'm just putting it out.
In Venom 2, he's going to be a radio DJ. Yeah. And he's going to throw him in there for a radio
scene.
Spoiler
alert. Yeah. Spoiler alert.
We just broke news.
Audio books were in screenplays. Right? Screenplays.
Hey, I'm open to that. It's not a bad idea.
I'm going to start with you, by the way, because I'm genuinely curious about this. I love following you and Rock on Instagram. This is actually separate from a specific movie question, but you do a lot of Rock's photography.
Yeah.
Whether it be on set or for his Instagram. How do those moments organically happen? Are you just always there with the camera? Do you, like, for example, you posted a photo the other day of Rock and Danny DeVito walking from a plane.
Yeah.
Are they aware they're in a photo, or are you just kind of snapping along?
Yeah, the one thing is I'm a large person, so I end up being in your vision.
It's not subtle.
It's not subtle, but it is. It's, you know, the great thing about shooting actors and talent is they're actually so used to cameras that it's, because you always want to disappear ultimately. You want to try and capture a candid moment. And the nice thing about hanging around actors and people who are always around cameras is they tend to just ignore you. Like, you can actually disappear and capture those moments that are really authentic and organic and just magical. And for me, I've always loved photography. Always, you know,
so
it's like,
good.
You know, thank you very
it's
much.
Really
but, you know, we're very fortunate. We get to produce these movies. We have a kind of a POV that a lot of people don't get to see. And I always remember growing up hearing about how Bruckheimer always had a camera on him. And, you know, and loving photographer, I'm always like, if I ever had the opportunity to finally become a producer and reach this dream, I want to be able to capture as many moments as I can. So I always keep a camera on me, you know, have a great relationship with Leica as an ambassador for them. And, you know, and just to be able to capture those moments.
Did you guys
and
get
tell
that?
The
he's
story.
A, he's a Leica
ambassador. Just a Leica ambassador. Just giving a little bit of a...
I just want to shine a light on that.
Mentioning the family.
You know, ambassador for Leica, you know.
But it is heavily sponsored. I love to be able to tell that story.
Would you ever want to be a DP?
No, I've never, you know, I let the pros do that. It's like, I was
would you ever
want to
be a DJ?
A DJ I would want to do. Right. But photography is that that's my platform to the tell DJ. The story. And I love to shoot the Tomek.
Tomek
loves the camera.
He took an amazing shot. He is an incredible photographer.
Yeah.
And took a
That's
great
because I take a lot of his pictures.
So. Yeah. some of the shots of me are extraordinary. I don't know if you've seen them.
It really captures that face for radio. Yeah, really great job.
He was able to do a gallery for Leica when we launched the camera, and a photo of Tomek,
made the
called
show.
It the Tomek, made the gallery.
Made
a very stunning image of him doing emails on a set for us, very producer-like.
It was kind of an iconic producer.
Which set was it?
It was the Oasis set in the movie, you know, when they go into the village.
Oh, in this film?
It
was on this set.
Film.
Okay.
Yes, and there's those targets against the wall. You know when the hatchet hits the wall?
Yeah.
So I'm standing against the wall.
Blasting emails out.
It was one of my proudest moments.
It was.
We walked onto that set, and with the whole crew to kind of scout the set. We hadn't seen it. And there were these targets on the wall with hatchets. And I don't know what possessed me. Do you remember this?
Yeah, oh, it was magic.
And I went and grabbed a hatchet and stepped back and threw it.
And that crew member was never seen again.
Right, exactly. But while the hatchet is spiraling in midair, I'm like, oh my God, whatever happens here is going to speak to who I am. Like, if the hatchet clanks on the ground, they're like, oh, Tomek. But if I nail it, and it nailed it.
Nailed
it. Remember?
True. As an OG, first shot. Only person did it. Everyone's standing around, thunk, and hits it right on the money.
And I was like,
yeah.
And you were like, now
that's
the
man.
So here's what we're doing.
Hero moment.
That's right.
Now where's my Starbucks?
Almond milk latte.
That's hilarious.
So he captured that moment. It was cool. Yeah.
All right. I want to go back to the first movie when you guys make the decision, or the decision is made that you're going to go up against Star Wars.
Yes.
Talk about just that decision, but then I also want you to talk about having the confidence now to come out with a sequel and realize, again, you get to go up against another Star Wars.
You know, a huge credit to Sony, you know, to Tom Rothman and Josh Greenstein, who were the ones who, you know, we were making the movie, who said, we think this is Christmas, you know, and I think we all felt, as you would, like, what? You know, because at that point we don't, you know, we're the new kid on the block.
Sure.
Yeah. And we believe in what we're doing, but it hasn't come out yet. People haven't. And there's this movie sitting there called Star Wars. And so there was a huge gulp. But they were immediately really, really bullish on what we were doing. And I think, and we quickly rallied around it with a healthy dose of anxiety.
Let me just say, like, he's being very... We were very aware of, like, as giant Star Wars fans, the amount of times we were like, bro, we're going against Star Wars. Is everyone sure we want to? And especially with that movie, there was so much buzz around, you know, about that movie and what was going to happen, that we had a ton of moments where, like, we really sure we want to come out against Star Wars.
But there's no good window, though.
No,
honestly.
You just got to take it on.
There's never a good window.
Yeah.
And what you have to believe in the movie, and what we all got very clear about, and what, you know, it's the right time for this movie. And I think that's, you know, when you're having a conversation about release dates, obviously you have to be aware of what else is on your date or close to your date. But to the extent that a movie can actually capture the spirit of a time of year, you know, that this is a holiday movie, that it's a movie about people coming together and being there for each other, which is sort of in the holiday tradition, it just felt like it was good timing. And, you know, we had a few fairly major movie stars in our arsenal also. So, yeah, we were showing up with the goods, but still, it was super, super daunting.
And we had the confidence, and I'll say in this, knowing we always knew Star Wars is a monster. We're him and I alone are fans of it. But it's one of those things
we were always going to be there
for that movie opening. But the one thing that we felt confident in is that Star Wars still is a tone in itself. And the thing that we had that we felt really good about was that we felt we wore we were an 8 to 80 movie that, like, on a holiday when the family's together and everyone's deciding, all right, we've all seen Star Wars, what do we see next? Well, we're the movie that we know from the little kids to grandma. There's going to be jokes in there, there's going to be fun in there, and you're going to leave having a big, fun, good time with our movie. And that was the thing that we always felt confident with. So we're not trying to dethrone Star Wars. We just want to coexist with it, and we were able to in a really cool way.
And by the way, you realize you can. I mean, that was the amazing takeaway is both movies did incredibly well.
Right. Almost $1 billion later.
Yeah. And yeah. So, you know, that's for those of us making movies at a time when there seemingly aren't that many windows or weekends.
Right.
You can succeed
in a crowded
marketplace.
And I'm not
if you have the
blowing smoke or saying this because you guys are here. For my 11-year-old son, like that first Jumanji, your Jumanji, is his Star Wars.
So good.
That's the greatest thing ever.
Like the Star Wars stuff is super into it for me, and my sons both like it. But my 11-year-old will go to your film.
Well, that's
over and over again. I'm serious. Like I see in him the attachment that I got to the early movies that I grew up on.
That's the greatest thing in the world. That, you know, we're creating a new franchise for a new generation of people who are gonna have that same allegiance. I mean, Star Wars is the gold standard, know, and that's the greatest. I have a 13-year-old who has no choice but to say that he loves it. we have an understanding. But same thing with his buddies. Yeah. And it's the greatest thing.
Because you can't force it, you know?
Oh, and they get to own it. And that's the, you know, growing up, that was the coolest thing. The movies that were yours, you know, that you saw as a kid, that were made for you. You always have a thing, you know.
But my oldest says Jurassic World over Jurassic Park, and I've disowned him.
This is more of a distribution question, but I'm curious about this from a producing standpoint. So you open the 13th, back to Star Wars one more time they open the 20th.
Yes.
Does that affect your theater count? Like what happens? Like so when you open your movie in over 4,000 screens, is that something you have to take into account when you deal with Star Wars opening a week later? How does that play out on your end? That's something you guys don't even have to think about or worry about.
No, you know the nice thing is that those are the two big holiday. Well, there's actually a couple holiday films, but at that time, you know you're going to be fine. I think the only time sometimes you get into, and I'm sure you've dealt with this, where you can get into a little bit of logistics issue is when you start dealing with specialty theaters like IMAX. And stuff like that, and maybe if you're international, if you're dealing with like 4D screens, that's where you start. There's more.
You can go week at IMAX if you want.
Yeah,
right?
There's less property in terms of how long a film can stay at those because there's less screens. Right. So other than regular theatrical, it's fine. But when you're dealing with stuff like IMAX, and when you're dealing with like 4D, that's where you can get into a little bit of choppiness in terms of how much time do we get and how much time does this one get. You know, I'm sure you've experienced that too.
Where do you guys think 3D is going? Curious about that.
It's a good question. You know, look, for me, I feel like 3D isn't as big domestic-wise. I feel like, you know, everyone's got TVs here, the 3D and so forth, but 3D, internationally, they still really love 3D, and they love, you know, that adds to the theatrical experience where, you know, you go to places to like China where the theaters are all new and super elaborate, and so the 3D going experience is always plays very big international that we see in terms of for us.
There's a cautionary note in it though. I mean, I think, you know, when 3D came along, you know, this last time, it's come along before, it became, everybody saw it as the great answer. Like, this is going to be, everything should be, you know, dinner with Andre should be, like, everything. And it's just not true. You know what I mean? I think 3D works really brilliantly for movies that ask for it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I think it's additive, and I'm talking, for certain movies. Mm. But I think everything got sort of shoved in that bucket, and it diluted it a little bit for audiences.
Yeah.
But I do think there are movies that are meant to be that are enhanced that way,
like Gravity, or even like Scorsese did with Hugo.
That's right.
I mean, they use 3D as
it's baked into the idea.
Yes,
And I
not
think
the conversions.
But the funny thing is, the conversion where it is now, it's and I don't know what you guys ever did. Like I was able to make a 3D movie that used 3D cameras at the time. So it was right after
Red
Run Avatar. Yeah, and it was a whole process, and that was when you really at that time post-conversion was not up to to snuff, and you had to like the way you blocked and everything, and these cameras were always
going
down.
Oh, you were so not nimble.
It was
so
crazy.
Conversion became a fantastic
and now it's also very good.
It's gotten better,
and it's gotten way better.
Yeah, right.
And I think, like Hiram said, I mean, there are places in the world where it's quite popular, and I think it will continue to be a thing. But I, you know, for my purposes, I dig it. I still think, you know, you got to go out and make a good movie.
Yeah, yeah.
That connects with people, and then the 3D will enhance that. But it's not in lieu of.
Yeah, you mentioned the word international, and that to me, this is a global junket. We're at a junket where everybody across the world is here.
Yeah.
Your movies work for global audiences.
Yes.
What is that process like in the writing room and the producing room and the directing room where you're going, this movie can't not only play in America, it has to play everywhere? Like, because your global box office in the first Jumanji was massive. So how much goes into the thought process of how someone in China will get that joke, how someone in Japan will get that joke, how someone in India will get that joke? Is that something that you think about as a producer of like how it's going to land across the world?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Yeah.
There's no one sort of science that you apply. You know, there are kinds of comedy. You know, specifically verbal comedy is harder. You know, because languages are different and things change. You know, the implication and things change as they're translated. Physical comedy is always
universal.
Something that travels. Yeah. You know, brilliantly.
Talking comedy doesn't travel as much. Physical comedy does.
So, but there are dynamics and there's casting and different ways that you try to make your movie reflective of a global. Of a world, because we think of, you know, when we think about making a movie now, different than it used to be, we truly think of it going everywhere in the world. I'm old enough to remember when that really wasn't the primary consideration, and now we think about it all the time.
And you try and tell universal themes, I think, stories that can kind of, you know, go across seas, but the truth is, I think when we're fortunate enough to make the movies we do, it's you just get into a way of thinking that you automatically just naturally think in terms of, you just know there's certain rules. It's like, this is what's going to play to a bigger audience. This isn't. You know, there's certain thematics or certain storylines or certain places that you want to go. But once you get into that mode, you just naturally think in big kind of global storytelling ways. And you just feel something inside. If you're like, oh, this kind of thing isn't going to really play. It's not going to translate well, and we want to tell a story.
It feels like
that,
inside baseball versus
the most
something.
Eyes will be able to see, and that's the joy of a global story.
And I think you put your finger on it, which is, you know, you try to tell a story that's universal. You know, the thing for us always with this movie was, and we talked about it a lot, you know, that it is a universal notion, this sort of wish fulfillment, you know, that I, you know, people play video games, why? Because it's escapism, and you know, what if I could go in there and be powerful and fast and strong and impervious to whatever
the things that
plague me all day long weren't an issue. How great would my life be? And I think the slight flip on that is the movie asks you to finally appreciate your life having gone through that. But I think that emotional story or journey is for everybody. That's not a territory specific idea. Mm. I think all of us think about, you know, who could I be?
And it's why superhero films do so well, because it's the ultimate in wish fulfillment. And the truth is Jumanji in its own right is people becoming superheroes. Mm. You know, their own version.
Entirely.
I think it will always that genre will always play, because everyone's always had a dream of, could I be more? Can I be bigger? Just aspirational. And I think that's what superhero movies do, and that's ultimately what Jumanji does, where you get the wish fulfillment of being like, man, how cool would it be if I can just step into the body of this person, now I can do all this kind of crazy stuff.
Speaking of superheroes,
we're getting there.
Yeah.
I know where that's going.
Well, you teed it up.
Your leading man said something at the press conference that hit my ear, and then he said it a second time.
Yeah.
Multiple Jumanji universes.
Yes. Yeah.
Can you elaborate on what that might mean?
Yeah. Well, look, you know, I think one of the things was, and yes, we were always very proud of this. The first Jumanji, the very first one, Robin Williams, is so beloved. It was beloved to us, yeah. And what was important to us when we went and made Welcome to the Jungle was we didn't want to remake Jumanji. That was never the goal, because you want to let such a beloved film like that means so much to so many people stand on its own, and we wanted to build upon it. We wanted to expand the universe. So that's why we always acknowledge the movie. That world existed. What happened there, you know, you feel elements of it even in this movie. And so for us, the idea of expanding the Jumanji universe and the idea of there's different versions of the game. There's different ways the game can challenge you. And the bigger we can make the universe, the more opportunities and challenges we can give to our heroes. You've met some of the avatars. You meet new avatars in this movie. And when you start to get into that space where now we're creating a Jumanji universe, and every time you beat one version of the game, there's a new one. And, you know, we showed something that we always love in Welcome to the Jungle, the Bazaar, which was actually kind of like a gateway. When you get that mishmash of personalities, it's basically the idea of, like, that's a hub for little tastes of other Jumanji worlds over there that we've always really been excited about.
Yeah, that's right, that's right. And we've always talked about the possibilities, and we still do. And, you know, I mean, the game is a portal. You know, it's a game, and it lands you where it wants to land you based on what it thinks you need.
Right.
It happens to be busted, which also, you know, gives you a certain other, you know, layer of freedom creatively. But that idea that, you know, I mean, there's that moment in the movie when they drop into the jungle and you think, oh, I know what this is. And now he's going to pull up in the thing with the Jeep, and we're going to get in the Jeep, and we're going to drive away. And he flies over in a plane.
Right.
And Jack Fridge says, why is he in a plane?
Right.
And that's the movie saying to you, it isn't what you thought it was.
Right.
And saying to the characters, that's right.
Right.
And so, and the characters are, wait a minute. And that is the tip of, you know, what DJ was getting at, which is we can go anywhere we want in this universe. There are certain rules that are the rules of how the game plays, but even those are up for grabs because it got smashed by a bowling ball. So the idea is we can dream and land wherever we want to. And I think that's what he's talking about. And that's, you know, that's Knockwood. We're in a place to have those conversations.
And the game will continue to evolve, which we always loved, is that it was a board game before. It wasn't getting the attention it needed, and the game adapted to make sure it got played.
So don't ignore that game.
The game will always do what it needs to do to get played, which is a very cool thing.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, and obviously this is a great audience film, and people love watching it with an audience. Yeah. And I'm curious, as you've seen this film now with you screened the other night, when you watch it with an audience, is there a scene that landed exactly how you wanted it to land? Is there a scene that, like, just worked exactly how you envisioned it to work?
There's
so many, but...
Well, but it's also the kind of amazing alchemy of making movies is, sure, I mean, there are jokes that you know are going to land, you know. One of the gifts that just keeps giving in this movie is the cake joke.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, and anytime you say cake, it just crushes. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, but then there are other things that people just... You're screening the movie for the first time, and it's like... Some joke just destroys, and it's like, whoa, you know?
Yeah.
And or sometimes, not in this movie, when you're screening movies, they don't, you know, a joke doesn't play the way you thought it would. And that's just the kind of amazing, amazing outcome. You know, it's one of the things that I've always been fascinated by with working with comedy directors, and Jake is certainly one of them. And, you know, back in the day when I was an executive, I worked on a bunch of movies with, like, Adam McKay and you know, Judd and Seth Rogen and all these guys. And they all are... It's not me. It's not Judd.
That might have been worse than his like a name, John. I'm joking.
I see how that could play. I see how that could play.
Yours was pretty nonchalant, man. I'm not going to lie. That was pretty, like...
Blew right by it.
No, you said Judd. You didn't say Abbottown.
Yeah, you didn't say the full name.
Judd.
Judd Z. J. A.
P. J. Okay, there's no Adam before it.
Totally. It's radio. My point was, and Jake is very much in this school, the preview process, the screening process. These guys screen their movies over and over and over and over to watch jokes play. And the way they shoot, the way Jake shoots, is you're, you know, we shoot the scene. I mean, very much, you know, we shoot what's in the script, but then there's always a super healthy amount of try this, you know, and Jake will throw lines out and DJ and Kevin and Jack and everybody will riff with him.
Yeah.
And so then you end up with a cut of the movie and you're like, well, I got to try all this and figuring out what plays, what doesn't, filming audiences, watching the movies, seeing how they react is all part of that kind of comedy process. And Jake, the reason I dropped all those names, comes out of that school. And so, you know, we did a very healthy amount of that in the roll up to what you saw. And saw what played and what didn't play, and it was so. There's a science to it, which is kind of cool, yeah. And it's a little bit like it's not precious. It's like let's just get to what audiences are really loving,
and it's leaning on the audiences to get that information, which is so valuable. When you just realize, test it, see what they're responding to, because ultimately we're trying to make the audience happy, and the feedback you get from it is what's able to allow us to hone it. But also to your question, I'll just say. One of my favorite scenes that actually has a cool story to it is the bridge scene, our bridge sequence. And what's cool about that is we had actually been working on that sequence since the first movie. That was actually, we had big ambitions for that. We wanted to put it in.
Sure did.
Welcome to the Jungle. Didn't have enough time or money to pull it off. But that was something that had been in all of our minds for years. And so to finally be able to put it, we knew that was going in this movie. We went right back to it. We were like, we got to get that in there because we knew it was going to be big, awesome. And for us, it was always like the biggest challenge they had ever encountered yet, where, you know, tons of them are losing their lives. Everything's changing. But that sequence came off really awesome, and it was actually one of the first things we shot in the movie. Like, we kicked right off the gate, right away. Karen and Awkwafina's first day together, they were doing stunts and swinging on crazy stuff, and just jumped right into it because it was such a big monster sequence, and it turned out really badass.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
One of my favorite scenes. It's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, actually.
But it literally took years to kind of get it to the place that it was going to get. You know, the scene that always I remember read super funny was. When they first land in the jungle, the stretching, figuring out. So wait a minute, you are, and, you know, and Spencer, he's here, you know, and it played on the page. I remember the first time we read it. It had that who's on first quality.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And I said that to Jake. I was like, oh my God, it's like who's on first. And that always sort of lived up to its script.
Even the first movie too. That's one of those things that for me, I never get tired of watching them. Wait, you're who? And then trying out the body. It's just so much fun to see it. And we in Florida? What is...
That's right.
It's so good.
Pretty good DeVito. Well, Kevin, pretty good DeVito right there. Florida?
Kevin as Danny never gets old either.
It's almost like kind of scary how he nails it. Like, it's like there are moments where I was like...
Yeah.
What's going on here?
It's wild how those guys—they all did. They just
every one of
his characters,
like his delivery being too slow, like costing lives.
That's
a great line. That line,
that's a good
line.
Bit.
Did I just kill?
Yeah.
Like he always said I would.
Talking too slow.
That was
the old guy bit. Also, he laughs because he knows it's my favorite. I think for me, my favorite line of the movie is always Jurgen the Brutal. Is that Barber Boy? Oh, that line kills me every time. I know.
Why did you guys... was there ever... Jake actually confirmed this. Did you guys... Why did you take out the I'm too old for this shit? Like the classic Lethal Weapon callback. Like it was. He said that was like a bit there. Is that because it wouldn't work universally? Is it too inside baseball to Lethal Weapon?
A little bit.
Yeah.
That's what I was wondering.
A little bit, yeah.
Because I wondered how...
We had it.
He said that you had it. I was wondering how it got removed or...
It just felt like, it wasn't ours.
And you know, it's also... Also, it's gauging, honestly, that's, again, it's audience stuff. It's like, if the audience didn't bang on it, you're like, as much as we love it, again, it's a little bit dated right now.
Dated,
and just people weren't landing on it.
Yeah. Sure. All right. I'm glad you guys brought up the audience, and we are going to shift to comic book properties, because you two are responsible for some massive ones.
Yeah.
We love
comic books. Yeah, of course you do. Yeah. Venom obviously was an untested property. When you guys tried it out, and you were met with some enormous success, and I'm just wondering what that success told you as about the audience as you prepared for the sequel.
They love that relationship. You know, I mean, what people say all the time is the relationship between Eddie and Venom was it just, you know, like, I just want to spend more time
so
with those guys.
So good.
And
so
that's, and that is, you know, such a testament to Tom Hardy.
Right.
Who, you know, obviously played both parts. That was, so you, it's similar, and I'm not just trying to bring about Jumanji, like, it's the characters.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's the thing you want to hear when you launch a franchise, is that what works is the heart of the movie. And the heart of Venom was always the relationship between Eddie and Venom.
Right.
And these two characters, these two sides of the, you know, that had to figure out how to live together. And that were somehow better together than they were separately, or more successful, and what that meant. And then everything that surrounds it, you know, was great, and it was hard to get there in time and all of that. But that was the heart and soul of it, and really felt great to see that be the thing that people talked about.
How about my good buddy here, Matt Tolmach, having those two monster movies, Jumanji,
huge,
and Venom back to back?
That was a good year.
Billion.
That's a good year.
That's good producing. Yeah. This is
that makes
true,
up for the name drop.
True good friend and a very good, very great producer. And
that's
testament to that work.
Super sweet of you.
But then I saw, looking at the numbers today too, and I want you to get both of your perspectives on this.
Yeah.
Venom does $856 globally. Joker becomes the first villain, you know, R-rated movie to cross a billion. Why do you think audiences are reacting to villain-driven properties or standalone stories with villains when we never saw this kind of stuff before?
Villains are, or I would qualify it as sort of anti-heroes.
Okay. Sure.
You know, because I would say Venom is a different character.
Okay.
Venom in his own right is a hero. A dark hero with a very specific code.
He eats people.
But he eats bad. Eats bad people.
Bad people.
He does
bad
eat people.
Bad people.
He bites their heads off.
Bad people.
It's like the Boondock Saints. They're killing good. They're killing bad people.
So he eats bad people. Gotcha.
Right.
Yeah.
That makes it. I mean, you're about to make one of these.
Yeah.
I mean,
I think it's inherently, I think it's fascinating. I think for audiences, I think, look, we've always seen heroes. It's almost, you know, there's funny. It's like the parallels a little bit of like wrestling, right? When like Hogan was the prototype, you know, take your vitamins, say your prayers. And then when the shift came and Stone Cold, the guy who's stunning Santa Claus, you know, I think there's just something very interesting about a complex character who's not just good. And I think, so in the case of the Joker, here's a character who's arguably the greatest villain in comic book history, definitely so complex, and over the years of how he's been played, I think it's fascinating for audiences to be able to watch, how did that person get there? It's why we love watching thrillers and serial killer movies, or, you know, like, you know, Ted Bundy Files and stuff, because there's a fascination with, how does someone get to that spot? Like, from what's the journey? And I think to be able to see that in a way, too, where it's a little dangerous, you know?
Well,
Joker was a little dangerous to go and watch, and it's R-rated, and, you know, you're not getting the filter version, and it's also being critically received as arguably one of the best
movies of the
year.
Yeah.
I mean,
Yeah, that's true.
Yes.
Just, you know, going back to what you're saying about dangerous, one of the things we always knew about Venom, and I knew it anecdotally from my own kid, who grew up around a bunch of Spider-Man movies, but always wanted to wear a Venom suit. That was the suit he wanted, and that's not unique to him. Venom was always the highest-selling Halloween costume in that universe. Why? Because I think there's a...
Danger.
There's, danger is appealing to a point.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, how do I deal with things that are scary? Well, I try to own them, right? I try so that they don't own me. And I think kids, that flirtation with things that are otherwise scary is appealing.
Yeah.
And I think it's why people like watching complicated, dark characters.
Does the R-rated success of Joker make you think about an R-rated Venom 2?
I mean, I think you always have to think about that, you know, now... That works. You know, having said that, our movie worked really well. You know, our franchise exists as it is, and I don't think anybody is looking to just say, like, hey, they, you know, we have a place in the world. So it isn't like that suddenly everybody's considering, you know, what to do with
Could
the
you
rating.
Maybe? Like, was it something you'd think about because of Joker?
I think what Joker does is it tells you that you can succeed. You know, for a very long time, that was the narrative, and Deadpool, you know, sort of wrestled that to
Logan
the turf,
as well, you know,
and then Logan, but for a long time, that was considered totally forbidden.
Yeah,
you know. By the way, it was in comedy too.
Right.
For a long time.
Right. Sure.
Until some of the people whose names I dropped, who I will not drop.
So,
why would you say his name? You know, I think it's the greatest thing in the world that R-rated movies are being embraced by massive audiences. And it just means that there are more opportunities for that kind of storytelling.
It also means you can tell the story the way it's supposed to be. Like, ultimately, I think you never want to force a movie to go into a space it doesn't need to, just to be, oh, let's be a little bit more violent. But if the story truly needs it, it's very exciting as filmmakers that there's a space now for it, where you know that, like, if this is a character that needs to be told R, now you have the flexibility in the room to do it, and you know that you have a chance to succeed.
Venom would work well in R, I think. He works well in 13, but I think Venom could, like, the nature of him would be interesting as an R.
Right. Is Warner Brothers a little bit more flexible now? Has you guys been playing back and forth?
Warner Brothers has always been, they've been, I can say this, they're, you know, Warner Brothers has never been afraid of darkness, you know, and, you know, as we've seen in some of their DC properties before. But the great thing about, and us with developing Black Adam there, we've thrown a lot of stuff at the wall and they've never flinched at anything.
No,
and we've thrown some dark stuff out there. I mean, really, I'm looking, you know, Black Adam has a complicated past. He goes to complicated places, and they've always been right there by our side. And it's always just been about what's the best version of the story. And look, as producers, that's all you want to hear from the studios. When they have your back like that, like, let's just tell the best version of the story. Mm. But Warner's has always been very open to whatever's going to be best for the story.
Because of the world we're living in right now, with movie news and everything, you talk about best versions of story. And I know one of the big things happening right now is this Snyder cut of Justice League, and people are discussing it like it's everywhere.
Yeah.
And people want to get that vision out there. I'm just curious your thoughts as producers, that this story exists, that people are on the internet are asking for this cut. And I'm curious, just as producers in general, like, what, when you see a story like that, what do you think about it?
I think it's complicated. I think I do. I think it's complicated because it's, you always, our number one boss is the fans. Like, you want to take care of the fans. So the reason why we're able to do what we do, so that we can take care of the fans. I think what's challenging is there's just some logistics when you have a movie like that. You know, I think one of the great examples of a person's cut is the Donner cut, right?
Yeah.
So Donner's cut of Superman 2 is a testament to, like, the best version of that. But that was a time also where everything was done in camera and it was practical.
Right.
The truth is of a challenge, just as a studio, I can imagine, here is a cut of a film that was a highly intensive visual effects film. Mm-hmm. There's a whole other level of visual effects that need to be done. I mean, you're talking, I'm assuming most of this movie was shot on stages, green screen, blue screen, so you have to completely render. It is opening up a whole new world now of bringing in a visual effects team, having visual effects done, and these are complicated shots of flying and this and that, you know, so I'm sure just logistically, it's a lot more. If it was something like the Donner cut, where it's like, oh, everything's in camera, boom, 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 of course, there's a whole post-production aspect to this that makes things naturally just daunting that I gotta imagine for them to be like, we'd love to, but there's a lot of stuff that comes into play here for them, which I would see would be just a little
it's
bit of a challenge.
It's super complicated, and I understand why the fans want what the fans want.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And they feel that there's more that's unanswered there for them, and I totally understand that. I also, you know, I spent a lot of years as a studio executive.
Yeah, that's
how
I wanted to hear thoughts on this. Yeah.
And that's a scary proposition.
Yeah.
And you know, one of the things about both of us, you know, is, and this movie's a good example, you know, we take our partnership with the studio super seriously, in a good way. I mean, the studio pays for the movie. They support us. They give us the tools we need.
That's
right.
Like a bunch of
Exactly. So, you know, going rogue, or, you know, what is, I don't know if it's going rogue, but there's an element to the you know, the thing that comes out in the end is a collaboration between the filmmakers and the studio, and a lot of hard decisions are made along the way. I know nothing about what went into that.
Yeah. Sure,
same here.
I know nothing.
Yeah.
But, you know, the movies that you end up releasing are oftentimes the result of a lot of long, hard conversations about, you know, what everybody collectively thinks is the best.
Right.
So I think the proposition of just suddenly people watching, you know, cuts of movies, that I'm not sure where that goes.
Is it dangerous?
Well, I don't know where it ends up. I think there's a good thing
in the sense that you have, look, as a student, you have a fan base that is so hungry and passionate for stuff that you've made, like, and that's the best place to be, where, like, they love what you have, they want more of it, you know, so it's coming from a good place, but it's a delicate thing, and again, we're not privy to what's been going on with that, but I can see both sides of it, but ultimately, you know, it's, you always want to take care of the fans in some way, and I'm sure Warner's is doing their best right now to figure out where's it going to be that allows us to take care of the people that let us do what we
for
do.
Sure. Yeah.
And hearing the fans is huge.
Yeah.
And it doesn't necessarily mean whether you're going to release a cut or not, but hearing the fans, you know, it's one of the things to just jump to your next question. you know, people are asking, you know, are you going to make another one of these and all that? And we've said it, and we mean it. Like, knock wood, we hope this movie is received the way the last one is, and we want the fans to tell us that they want another movie, first and foremost. But you also want to listen to the fans in terms of, like, what did you love? What did you not? You know, it's painful sometimes to go on the internet and read what everybody says about your movie, but you can learn a ton.
Right, right.
And if you're fortunate and they're by and large loving it, but they're loving some stuff more than other, like, really important to hear them. Hmm. Really important to hear the fans in general.
Release the Kasdan cut.
you're seeing the Kasdan. Trust me, this is.
Before they kick us out of here, there's one other topic I have to get into with you. And you talk about listening to the fans. And I'm curious how involved you were in those conversations when Sony and Marvel were trying to figure out how to share Tom for the Spider-Man.
Not very involved. Okay. Yeah. I produced the Morbius movies. I mean, the Morbius movie, the Venom movies, a bunch of other stuff in that Marvel Sony world. Like you know, we've talked about a Kraven movie. We've talked, you know, Spider-Man. I'm an executive producer on those movies, and there are other people that are sort of driving those conversations.
Gotcha.
I mean, that's the God's honest.
But you'd like to get him back over.
I'm looking forward to.
Can your Venom
to Jumanji?
I want to see your Venom play.
Speaking
with
of Black Adam,
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you guys very much.
Thank you,
guys.
It's not a dodge. It's just straight up. I'm not in that dodge.
Yeah, no, we appreciate you guys. Thanks for letting us go a little dirty.
No, this is great. The more nerd, the better.
It's really fun.
Naturally, we want to thank everybody over at Sony for setting this up. I mean, it was really great that they brought us to the Jumanji, the Next Level Junket. But in addition, I thought it was really cool that they went out of their way to book these podcast interviews, both with Jay Kasdan and then here with the two producers, to allow us to bring you additional coverage from the movie because it's a lot of fun. It's a good sequel. They're going to be competing up against Star Wars as the producers talk to us here on the podcast. And so we want you guys to go out and support it. Keep it here at the Real Blend Podcast for all of these upcoming really exciting interviews that we have through the rest of the month. Some huge names. Obviously, I have been teasing the Quentin Tarantino interview, the full one that's going to be coming very soon, but we have some really other great names, cool guests that will be coming to the podcast soon. We really appreciate you guys showing us the support, whether it's through the main show or these spin-off bonus episodes where we bring you exclusive interviews. So keep the feedback coming, keep the reviews coming, keep following us along on both the Real Blend Twitter account at Real Blend and now the new Facebook community page that we just launched. So many different ways for you guys to interact with not just us, but all the members of the Blender family. And we'll talk to you guys when we're back with the full episode. Dunkirk!
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.